So that was a good attempt at the title. Here's the accurate version. I'm talking about work done with Herman Verlinde and John Pearson, who are both at Princeton, that appeared on the net a few weeks ago. It's about brains and fluxes, and a strange analog of brain, anti-brain annihilation that happens when you don't have the brains, but you have the anti-brains. But it relates to other things that I hope you're interested in. So the general class of systems I'm interested in discussing looks like the following. It's something that shows up often in string theory, especially if you're interested in brain world scenarios. So you compactify the string, a type 2 string, on some Calabi-Yau manifold and tilde. And then in addition, you can do a few other, there's some bells and whistles you can add. There's some brains transverse to the Calabi-Yau, on which maybe if you're interested in brain worlds, the standard model is. So say three brains filling space. And then the Calabi-Yau has various topologically non-trivial cycles. The theory has p-form gauge fields, which have field strengths. And you can consider putting fluxes of those field strengths through the cycles. So the general kind of system I'm interested in discussing is a system that has brains and a Calabi-Yau and some fluxes. Okay, now, this same kind of system shows up with many different applications in mind. So one of the applications of this kind of system is to constructing, within the relatively tight framework of string theory, examples of warped compactifications. So if you're interested in making things that could explain hierarchies by large warping, a la Randall and Sundrum, but you want to work in the straitjacket of string theory, this would be a good place to look.
But what you're saying is that this, brains are in other dimensions than Calabi-Yau?
Yeah, they're transverse to the Calabi-Yau, and in everything I'll talk about here. You don't like the phrase straitjacket,
no.
Steve?
Okay.
Well, anyway, I'll be in that straitjacket for this talk. So a second application, not unrelated to the first, is moduli exist in most string compactifications. The Calabi-Yau has shapes and sizes of things within it. They're a disaster from any phenomenological point of view. You'd like to stabilize them. And this kind of model is also, it turns out, a good computable arena in which to discuss the stabilization of moduli. I might have time to say a little bit about that at the end, though it's a logically distinct subject from what I'll talk about most of the time today. And a last application in which this kind of system arises is in what I'll call variants of ADS-CFT duality, but where you have neither the ADS, it's been replaced by this thing, nor the CFT. You've broken conformal invariants, and in many cases, you've broken a lot of the supersymmetry. So if you want more and more realistic examples more and more interesting gauge theories with dual holographic, anti-holographic descriptions, this is a good kind of system to look at. So most of my talk will focus on this third kind of problem, and maybe at the end I'll get a chance to come back to the second kind. So let me discuss a prominent recent example in this setting of a gauge theory gravity duality. It's due to Klebanov and Strasser, though it builds on work of many people. So what's our starting point going to be? Well, I need to tell you about brains and fluxes and a geometry, so let me start with the geometry. The geometry will be the simplest example of a singular geometry in string theory, in some sense. Maybe it's not simpler than orbifold singularities, but it's one of the simplest, most generic examples. It's called the conifold. And it looks like this. You have an S3 times an S2, and there's some what we can call a radial direction r over which the sizes of the S3 and S2 vary. And at a crucial point, r equals 0, they both shrink to 0 size. So it looks like this cone. Okay. And in terms of complex geometry, you can describe this structure by having four complex coordinates that satisfy a simple equation. Because this equation is so simple, it's sort of the most generic singularity that comes up in Calabi-Yau. So we have this geometry, and we're going to consider a duality that arises when you consider both the gravity background and the quantum field theory that lives on some brains that are probing this background. So the brains we're going to use are MD3 brains. So this is a six-dimensional geometry. The three brains will be transverse to it, and we'll stick them at the tip of this cone. Okay. And then for extra fun, as we'll see in a moment, we'll sometimes add some number of D5 brains wrapping the S2 and sitting close to this tip. We'll always keep m much less than n because, as you'll see in a moment, that's where the physics makes the most sense. Now, in the case when m equals 0, so it's just three brains at this tip, there's a well-known version of ADS-CFT duality that comes out of studying, you know, either the quantum field theory on the brains or the gravity background. So the quantum field theory has been argued by Babanov and Witten to be an interesting n equals 1 supersymmetric conformal field theory, which, to the extent that it makes sense to discuss such a thing in a conformal field theory, has an SUN times SUN gauge group, and has a matter content that consists of a bunch of box, box, bars, 2 in the NN bar representation and 2 in the N bar N representation. Now, just the gauge theory with that field content and N equals 1 supersymmetry is not a conformal field theory. But there's also a quartic superpotential. Okay, so you take the A's and B's I was talking about, you can track them in the way that makes a gauge invariant with some parameter lambda, and you add that superpotential. Now, there's an interesting thing about this superpotential. If you're used to doing free field theory, this is clearly irrelevant. Okay, but it turns out that there's conjectured to be, there's strong evidence for the existence of, a strongly coupled line of fixed points where there are big anomalous dimensions for the fields. So this thing turns out to be exactly marginal, and lambda is then a dimensionless parameter that parameterizes different conformal field theories, as is one combination of the SUN times SUN gauge couplings.
But this potential came from original gauge coupling, or what is lambda?
So the theory a priori would have three parameters, a gauge coupling for SUN1, a gauge coupling for SUN2, and this parameter lambda. And it turns out...
Which is an additional one, right? So it's not a gauge coupling.
Right. So a priori there would be three, and it turns out that two of them are exactly marginal. Okay, there's a two-dimensional space of exactly of conformal field theories that you can sweep out in G1, G2 lambda space.
So there are four and three, right?
Well, in the gravity dual, I'm thinking of the dilaton and the fluxes of the B field through the two-sphere in the geometry T11. So.
Yeah.
Oh, you're talking about double trace. I'm sorry. Yes. If you include double trace deformations, there's a whole other story, which I haven't discussed.
But in this sense, it means that this superpotential, you can put lambda 0, for example, right? So it's not that this superpotential is related to something else.
I think that the line of fixed points doesn't pass through lambda equals 0. It does? Really? So SUN times SUN?
Yeah.
It's just a set.
Just
oh, okay, good.
Someone, is a superpotential imposes that the frame C and copies the conical.
Right, so if something...
You won't see this very easily, too.
Okay, good. So the gravity dual of this setup with its various parameters is thought to be 2B string theory on an ADS space to get the conformal field theory. And on some manifold called T11, what T11 is topologically is just a two-sphere times a three-sphere. So we have that picture of the S2 times S3, and you should think of T11 as sort of encoding that with what I call the radial direction in the picture of the conical being the radial direction of this ADS model. So that's the story.
Isn't log corrected ADS file?
Excuse me?
Isn't it log corrected ADS file?
This is going to happen now. Okay. So now we're going to break conformal invariants. We'll do that by adding some D5 brains wrapping the S2 in this S2 times S3. Okay. So they also fill space then, and they change the gauge group and matter content. And the resulting theory is instead of SUN times SUN, SUN plus N times SUN, and you still have box, box, bar, plus box, bar, box. But it's now no longer a conformal field theory. For M small compared to N, the smart way to think about it is probably by sort of perturbing about the old fixed points. So that's how we'll sort of think about it. And if you do that, instead of conformal field theory, if you fix the couplings here at some scale, you get an interesting pattern of running that was elucidated by Klebanov and Strasbourg, which results in a renormalization group cascade. Okay, so what I mean by that is the following. You have the two gauge couplings of these two factors. So here I'm plotting one over the coupling, one of the groups in black, the other in blue. And here's sort of energy space. Okay, and as you go towards lower energy, the group that has sort of less flavors compared to its number of colors is getting strong, while the other group is getting weakly coupled. So here this one is getting strongly coupled. Finally, the coupling reaches infinity. Now, it doesn't make a lot of sense to talk about that field theory. But luckily, this structure of bifundamentals with that kind of superpotential admits a dual description due to Seiberg. Okay, and it turns out that the structure of the theory, the quartic term, and the fact that you have a product group with bifundamentals is roughly left invariant by those dualities. So you get another theory that looks like a product gauge group and a cortex superpotential, but the number of colors in one of the gauge groups changes. So you get here to very strong coupling, you decide that you would rather work with a dual description, you dualize, and what happens is the SU, the strongly coupled factor, loses rank. So now it starts running towards weak coupling.
Dual description should be in a weak coupling. So why are you putting them, and in your picture it looks like it's also in some coupling.
Well, all I'm going to say is it now starts running towards weak coupling and the other factor starts getting strongly coupled. So that's why I've drawn it this way.
No, I mean, this N minus M, it's a weaker coupled CV, right?
That's in the infrared. So all I'm doing is dualizing at some high energy scale.
You came to the point in infrared where you have a strong coupling, right?
Yes.
And you are saying, okay, let's consider dual description, which would be SU N minus M, right? Uh-huh. And this one would be, and this is the same point in a weakly coupled phase, right? Otherwise, why you would do it?
Kadi, I can give you a nice clean justification of these various steps. This is somewhat, what he said here is somewhat hand waving, but let it go.
Okay.
I got it. Okay, so you will be moderated.
I can give you a nice detail.
Okay. So all I'm going to say about this, waving the hands vigorously, is that this factor now becomes weakly coupled. The other factor starts to become strongly coupled. The story repeats. Okay, it's sort of self-similar because the duality preserves this form. And it keeps on going until finally one of the factors has so few flavors that more interesting physics happens, a la Slavery's old work of the mid-90s. Okay, so here we have this repeated in words. You have this cascade where first one and then the other factor keeps on getting strongly coupled, and you have to dualize. Now, I'll take the simple case where n, the number of brains, three brains, is an integer multiple of m, the number of five brains. That's just for convenience for now. Okay, and if you do that, the last step in this cascade has been argued to be a pure SUM theory. So you keep on going, you dualize, you lose rank. At the last step, you have SUM times SU0, okay, and you get this thing. And this theory is pretty interesting. It has rich infrared physics. It has chiral symmetry breaking and Gaugino condensation and some set of strongly coupled vacua. So what one can provide is a gravity dual for this theory that replicates some of this physics. And the gravity dual is really simple to describe in the language of brains and fluxes and geometry. It's just a conifold with flux. So we started out with that conical space. And the conjecture is that what happens at the infrared end, if you will, of the gravity dual is just that you smooth out that singular cone. So it used to be an S3 times an S2 with both becoming small at the tip. And the conjecture is you should instead look at a space where the S3 doesn't collapse at the tip. So you've smoothed it out by fattening the S3 at the old tip of the cone. And there are two natural three cycles in that geometry. There's the S3, and there's another three cycle that you can say is sort of the S2 times the radial direction. And we'll call those the A and B cycle if we need to. And in terms of equations, that deformed conifold just looks like this. So you still have X, Y, Z, and W, four complex variables. But the equation is now that they're not equal to zero when you add their squares, but instead some parameter epsilon. And epsilon here is somehow supposed to be related to the dynamical scale of this final SUM step in the cascade. Now, intuitively, so this is the picture. You have these this conifold. I haven't said anything about brains. Okay, we're not going to add brains. But you can ask what sort of happens to the D3 charge. Where did it go? And a convenient way to say it is it's now encoded in fluxes in this geometry. So if you look at the equations of type 2 string theory, there are two different contributions to the D3 charge. You can get D3 charge by sticking in charged objects, D3 brains, but you can also get it by sticking in fluxes of the two three-form fields that exist in type 2B string theory, which we'll call H and F, one from the Nebo-Schwartz sector and one from the Ramon-Ramon sector. And the conjecture is that in the gravity dual, you should have this geometry with some of these fluxes turned on. So you turn on m units of Ramon flux through the A cycle, k units of H flux through the B cycle, and then the charge is what you'd expect.
And this non-compact conifold, the B cycle isn't really a cycle.
It's infinitely big in the radial direction.
So this is So when you guys compactified the store, you got a precise flexibilization, but at this level, that isn't really.
At this level, you'd have to worry about issues at infinity, and on the gauge theory side, there are also issues at infinity, because the cascade would continue with a growing rank towards the UV, and you wouldn't really stop at any finite rank gauge theory. All those issues, this is also Miriam's question about only having logarithmically ADS, and these won't be relevant to what I talk about. Is that what you were asking about, or were you asking something else?
The fact that you choose k to be an integer is not clear until you compactify it.
So then one can take this dual geometry and ask how you see various things about the gauge theory. Different people have explored different aspects of that. So for instance, if you wanted to see the m vacua that you expect in the system, the gravity theory itself should know that there are m different vacua. How does that come about? Well, if you turn on fluxes in a background, the fluxes have kinetic terms. They have some energy in them. And that energy results in, you know, some energy in the low in the lower dimensional effective theory that you might want to think about, which you'd like to minimize. And it can be encoded in a useful way in a superpotential. This kind of formula comes from work of Vafa and many others. So here, F and H are the fluxes. Tau is the type 2 dilaton, and omega is a preferred form in this geometry, the holomorphic 3 form, which exists for any Calabi-L. So there's a superpotential that looks like this. You study it as a function of the sizes of all the cycles in that conifold, in this case, the 2-3 cycles. Okay, and if you minimize the resulting potential, you'll get the expected supersymmetric bracket. So I'm not going to go through the calculation, but that's an example of how various things you expect from the gauge theory come out, and there are much more intricate examples of that kind. So what I'm going to talk about instead, this is one of the best understood, and
sorry, can I just ask, this is just a classical effect then, the supergravity thing?
Absolutely. Absolutely. In the end, if you work in the right regime, the geometry is big and smooth.
Yeah.
The tip of the cone is smoothed out. There's some fluxes. And you can just do a classical supergravity calculation and see the impact. Oh, and that brings up a point that might be relevant later if I talk about it. These flux kind of energies, they are purely classical in supergravity. But in various dual pictures, or in a dual gauge theory picture in this case, they can be encoding what you would normally call non-perturbative physics. Okay. Now, what I want to do is take this very well-studied and pretty example of a less ADS and less CFT duality and modify it to try and get a system that doesn't have supersymmetry, but where one can still say some things, there's still somehow some control. Okay. And there's an easy option that one always thinks of when one wants to break supersymmetry, especially after all Sen's work in the last few years, which is just add antibranes. Okay. So we could imagine doing that in various ways. The most straightforward.
Your goal is to understand non-supersymmetry strongly coupled gauge theories in this context.
My real goal in doing this was somewhat different, and I'll get to it at the end. But I'll take that as a toy problem. my real goal is. Let me explain what my goal was in doing this at the end, because it's irrelevant to what we actually do in the talk. But my goal is to find a way of making de Sitter vacua in string theory, okay? And de Sitter vacua. And that'll become clear as we go along, maybe and maybe not. Okay. But to do that, you need to break supersymmetry. De Sitter vacua have positive cosmological constant. Okay. And but just as a gauge gravity question, it seems pretty well motivated to go ahead and take this sort of frontier example and try to push it a little further. So that's how I'm going to talk about it here.
But you're not worried about stability. It's usually the problem is that even if you find some of this.
I absolutely am, and I'll address issues of stability as we go along. Right. Okay. So the easy option is just add antibranes. And let's do that at the start of my talk. So we have this conical space with a sharp tip here where we had stuck MD3 brains, and there were MD5 brains, and I didn't have another color that would show up, so I didn't draw the D5 brains. And then we add some number P of antibranes to maintain some kind of parametric sense in which the supersymmetry breaking is small. I will make P small compared to M and N. And recall, we already had M small to N, so there's some hierarchy of discrete choices here.
But this configuration, strictly speaking, could be unstable, right, by itself?
That will be, of course, the whole subject of the rest of my talk.
Yeah.
Okay, so the way I've drawn it here, it's very obviously unstable. And you already know what would happen because you've been reading Sen's papers for the last many years. So if we just added the PD3 bars like that when we had the ND3s sitting there, okay, the geometry is pretty much irrelevant intuitively to what would happen. We guess what would happen is the PD3 bars would annihilate with P of the D3s. Okay, and you know there's the open string tachyon story, blah, blah, blah. But at the end of the day, what would happen is instead of an SUN plus M times SUN theory, you'd have an SUN plus M minus P times SUN minus P theory, okay, after the brains and anti-brains annihilate. This one, we argued, had this nice cascade structure and flowed down, if N was a multiple of M, to pure SUM Yang-Mills. This one, you know, so now N is not going to be a multiple of M, we shifted it by P, but it's still a nice supersymmetric theory. It undergoes this cascade. The final step one would talk about would look like this.
But it looks like just in definition what you call N, right? You just change N by M minus P.
I understand, but before I had said N is K times M.
Yeah.
So if N was K times M before, it no longer will be.
No, but it's a little bit kind of cyanetical, right?
No, I agree.
No, it ends differently.
It ends differently. Okay, so it would end in this case with this kind of product theory. Okay, and if you study the gauge dynamics of this theory, below the scale of this group where this thing becomes strong, it would just look like M minus PD3 brains probing the conflict.
What sense is it supersymmetric?
It's an N equals 1 supersymmetric gauge theory, and it does not dynamically break. So the brains and anti-brains first annihilate.
Then you
go ahead and follow the process. Okay, so that's, you know, that's pretty dull. As he was saying, all you did is shift the definition of N to N minus P. This is a case that's already been studied. Who cares? Okay. Now let's try to imagine the same thing another way, so that we have something to talk about for the next half an hour. We could instead imagine not adding these PD3 bars when you have the tip of the cone and ND3 brains, but add them at the end of the picture, okay? I.e., let's take the dual description of the infrared, or this theory, which is an A cycle and a B cycle, and various units of Ramond and NS flux, okay, and a resolved smooth conical, and let's add the D3 bars there. Yeah.
So how do you distinguish those two cases? What's the essential distinction in terms of the...
Well, I just described two totally different string theory backgrounds to you. So.
Well, okay, I guess, yeah, on the string theory side, on the gauge theory side.
I'm going to get, that will be also the subject of the rest of my talk. So these are all the right questions. Okay. So on the string theory side, another option would be to take the conifold with flux and stick PD3 bars, sort of where the conifold used to be before it was smoothed out. So now at least the extremely boring solution can't happen right away because there are no brains for the anti-brains to annihilate with. We still have brain charge sitting around in the system. It didn't go away, but it's encoded in fluxes. Okay, and there's no magical way for the brains and fluxes to just disappear. So you can imagine a process of brain flux annihilation, which I'll also say a little bit about, but it has to be somewhat subtle compared to the normal brain anti-brain. So there, it turns out, I think the answer is in ADS5, the D3 and anti-D3 are both supersymmetric. I think the anti-D3 preserves the conformal supercharges. We can talk more about that later. I don't think there's an analog of this in just ADS5 cross S5.
You think in the near horizon limit?
I think in the near horizon limit, something really funny happens, yeah. Gary, you had a question.
Well, I just wanted to understand. So the flux that you have in this case is just the flux that's left over at the end, so it's just N?
It's M units of Ramond flux and K units of NS flux. So the total D3 charge there is still N, K times M.
Oh, I see. So when you're going through all of these sort of cascades, the total D3 charge doesn't change.
It all stays the same. Intuitively, it's getting traded between D brains and fluxes, I would say. And that'll become clearer as we go on. Okay. But. Well, okay, so my intuition would anyhow be that we now have a different theory here. We have the anti-brain sitting there, there's fluxes, and there's a smooth geometry. But we'd like to think that this is somehow connected to the thing, the boring thing I just talked about, where you started with the brains and anti-brains and they annihilated. Okay, and to bolster that intuition, notice that this theory admits domain walls. Okay, so it's a system with many vacua. And these domain walls actually allow the flux to jump. Okay, so these NS and RR fluxes through the three cycles can change as you pass through such a domain wall. So for instance, a microscopic description of such a domain wall, to take an NS5 brain and wrap it on a 3-sphere, so it extends out into 2 plus 1 dimensions in R4, and the 3-sphere I'd like to pick is the A-cycle. If you consider an NS5 brain wrapping the A-cycle, so it's a domain wall in spacetime, as you cross it, because of the magnetic couplings of the NS5 brain, the flux through the dual cycle of the NS3 form jumps by a unit.
But the main walls will be not electron staples, a theory, right?
I'm just trying to say there's a bigger theory in which there are different vacua. Yeah. And this vacuum that I've just talked about, whose properties we haven't said much about, will be connected to other vacua through these domain walls.
Right, but it would be excited state of your
system. Yeah, and I'll get to that too, of course. Yeah. I agree.
Does you pull off a string between the two objects when they pass through each other?
So the geometry is
charge conservation when there's
three rings.
There's three brain charge that jumps at this wall. No, I'm just using this right now as a thought experiment to say if you had such a wall, what would happen? Nothing is moving through the wall right now. Okay.
I'm sure the constructive example compares the walls.
You mean if you move the walls through each other or something?
Yeah, you have an S wall and G wall.
Okay.
Are these vacua, are they degenerate?
No. So that also, that's all my subject. It's on the next transparency. Okay. So we have this domain wall. It separates these vacua, as is clearly obvious to the entire audience. Okay. Now, if you imagine going through this domain wall, the one that I've described this way, the flux jumps by one unit. I was calling the flux k. I was saying there were k units of NS flux through the E cycle. That could jump to k minus 1. Now, there was D3 charge contained in the fluxes through this formula. Okay, and if k jumps to k minus 1, the amount of D3 charge stored in the fluxes jumps by m. What that means is that wall has to have m brains on its other side sticking there, m D3 brains. Okay, so you liberate m units of D3 charge to be, you know, wandering happy D3 brains on the other side of this domain wall. And what they can do is now annihilate with our PD3 bars. So on the other side of the domain wall, starting from this weird vacuum with fluxes and anti-D3s, we have the happy theory we talked about at the beginning, the simple variant of what Matt and Igor already discussed, where you just sort of shifted in a little bit and you didn't quite get down to pure QCD. Okay. And that theory is supersymmetric.
Couldn't you have said this just by saying, well, we started off with the theory which has n the multiple of m, mm-hmm. and we just start adding probes.
That's how you guys did it. Yeah, that's how you did it.
Well,
I think
yes, although we didn't really explore how the transition should occur.
I agree, but this.
I think even assembled together into an NS5 brain.
Yeah. Well, okay. There are two different things you could be talking about. You could be talking about this non-supersymmetric vacuum, which
I'm just perfectly happy to add in some probe brains. Everything's perfectly supersymmetric, but I want to see that when I add an M probe, I'm back at the original theory.
Yeah, I'll do that too in a minute.
Right. But in terms of the domain rules, you also can have, you know, domain rules where this K is changing not by one unit, right? Because you have,
you could repeat it many times.
But it could be kind of bound state of those domain walls. So, for example, it could be, in this sense, a new domain wall, because which carries on more units of...
The system has many, many different vacua separated by many different domain walls. I'm just focusing on this one, because it's somehow the crucial one that goes between the non-supersymmetric state and the supersymmetric state. Okay. Let me try to say that now. Okay. So here's some natural thoughts, which everyone in the audience has already naturally been thinking. Okay. First of all, I was saying that this theory with the P anti-brains and the supersymmetric conifold with fluxes, which are mutually non-supersymmetric, so it's a non-supersymmetric theory. But since it's a vacuum of a system that also has supersymmetric ground states, you'd expect it to decay. Okay. And the way that will happen is by NS5 bubble nucleation. Okay. It's some vacuum off somewhere else, but the NS5 brain wets it decay. We just discussed that. So it'll nucleate these bubbles of NS5 brain, and they will take it to the supersymmetric endpoint. In the regime that I'm going to study, where P is much less than N, this is a non-perturbative process. You can estimate the rate. The rate's very slow. It's exponentially small in various parameters. Okay, so we can talk about this state meaningfully. It's interesting that actually as you crank up P relative to M, you get to a situation where it's no longer a non-perturbative process, and in fact, the anti-brains just sort of morph continuously through the flocks into free range. But I don't have much to say about it. So we have a long-lived metastable state. That doesn't mean that the D3 picture we started with, the D3 bar picture, is itself metastable. It's also unstable on much faster timescales to something else. Okay, and I'm going to talk about that now. There's a perturbative instability. So our picture is that the initial state has these fluxes in the D3 bars. It's not supersymmetric. Here's the starting point. You roll down this potential to a metastable vacuum, still non-supersymmetric, okay, and then you eventually decay to the supersymmetric vacuum. So there's yet another unknown state in here somewhere that I have to tell you about. Okay. So the final state then, at the end of all the tunneling, is you've ended up down here, and you have only D3 brains left and some fluxes which are mutually supersymmetric with the brains.
You're told what psi is eventually.
Oh, good. So psi right now is schematically a field which has a potential. In two different pictures, it means two different things. But you should just be thinking of it as some field theory field on the brains, which has a potential. And I'll talk about that. Yeah, this is just intuition. Okay, a second intuition you might have is the following. We have a very long-lived gravity state of these brains and fluxes and so forth, which decays to the supersymmetric state. We had a holographic dual for the supersymmetric state due to Igor and Matt. So we might hope that we can find a long-lived, metastable, non-supersymmetric field theory vacuum in the holographic dual description, okay, i.e. in this product supersymmetric gauge theory. And I'll give a heuristic argument in favor of this, I think time will allow. And I'll actually do that by going to a supersymmetric limit and talking about how jumps occur there. Okay, so any questions before we start exploring the first of those two intuitions? So what I want to talk about now is the perturbative instability, and I'll tell Joe what psi is partially. I'm going to talk about it in a way that's the most intuitively clear, but also is calculationally unjustified. And I'll do that because when you do the correct calculation, it turns out the answers agree. Okay. So here's the intuitive thing to do. You take PD3 bars, okay, and we're going to stick them in this flux background. Okay. The confold's been smoothed out, so there's a smooth geometry within these fluxes. And we want to ask, what's their dynamics? Okay, so in particular, since we expect an NS5 brain to play a role, we're gonna look at this Born-Infeld action in the S-dual frame. So this is the action on the V3 bars. It has these kinds of terms. These were worked out by Myers and lots of other people. Q is defined here. Okay, G is the metric. C is the Ramon-Ramon 2 form potential, and so forth. Okay, so C is the gauge field for which F3 is the field strength. And this F is actually a world volume gauge field. Okay, and the phis are the world volume fields on the D3 bar, so they're P by P matrices in the adjoint representation of SUP.
Is that supposed to be exact or some sort of leading terms?
Well, you then expand all of these things, and you only keep the leading terms for small phi. So anything I say will be for small phi, and that piece of it would be justified for p much less than m. The reason this is unjustified is because we're using the S-dual action and g is small. Okay, but at the end of this, once we get the answer, I'll tell you there is a justified calculation that gives the same answer.
You can throw away some of these complications, right? Just go from p to 1.
Yeah, okay, good. It's not too essential, right? Okay, so, we have a three-form F, so we can write the gauge field C in terms of the field strength this way, okay, quite explicitly. The metric, once we've gone to the smooth confold with fluxes, is locally flat. Okay, that's part of the magic of this duality. It's a nice smooth geometry that's dual to this interesting gauge theory. So we can plug into Myers' thing. Here's what Q is in terms of the commutators of phi. And I'm going through this slowly in case you don't do this kind of thing all the time, but these are standard manipulations. So you can expand the debt of Q in terms of various polynomials and the commutators of phi. And so this term here you should recognize as being the standard n equals 4 field theory potential. OK, okay, it's a commutator squared. This term here is a cubic correction due to the fluxes, and this term here just is the tension of the brains. Now, in this particular background, there was another term in Myers' action, and which I had included on the previous transparency. It's related to this one trivially because we're in a supersymmetric flux background. Okay, so there's an imaginary self-duality constraint on the fluxes. And when we put all that together, we end up with this expression for the potential. Okay, so this is all that matters from that transparency. And it says the potential is, well, there's the brain tension itself, which we can ignore for now. It doesn't tell us about dynamics, it's constant. And then there's this flux term, which is cubic, and then there's the old n equals 4 potential.
There's no f squared phi squared term.
There's no f squared phi squared term that I know about, no.
So this is like the dielectric D-brains?
This is exactly the dielectric D-brains. And so Wadi nicely went through that yesterday, and you're going to see it gone through again now, more slowly, in fact, than he did in his colloquium. But, yeah.
I think we don't see the f squared phi squared term because there's no the phi squared terms are not known in the polynomial body production, but well, it should be there in the columns.
Yeah. I mean, the D-brains want to sit at the bottom of the conifold because that's where the work factor is smallest.
Yes.
So there's a phi squared term.
No, not if it's supersymmetric.
No, it's not supersymmetric. It's non-supersymmetric.
Right.
The D3 raised when it sits at the bottom of the potential, so there
must
be a phi squared term.
That phi is. So there's two things you could be talking about: the center of mass.
Center of mass.
There I totally agree. They're drawn down by f phi to sit at the bottom
right,
of.
Right, but normally, in my work with Matt, f squared phi. I mean, you have two terms of what should be a three-term, complete square there.
Uh-huh.
So there should be an f squared phi. Shouldn't there be an f squared phi squared term to go with f phi cubed and phi to the fourth?
Isn't that a correction?
No, it's not. It's the same power as the other terms. They have the same rate. A little of them count.
Let me continue because we certainly didn't include that term. There's a question as to whether it's equally important as the things that are in this Myers-Born okay. action or not.
Yeah, yeah.
And I can't actually answer
Myers
that.
Myers didn't include it. It should have. I mean,
okay.
Yeah.
Good. Let me continue.
Yes.
Okay. So I'm going to continue with the potential as is, despite this disturbing correction. Okay, so first let's notice that this A cycle is large. Okay, so we can approximate what the field strength locally should be to give you the quantized flux. It looks like this. It's locally tiny, which is why I have hopes that F squared phi squared won't matter. It's locally tiny because you have a big cycle and a fixed flux in integer units. Okay, so it looks like that. And B naught is some number of order 1, and these factors of GM come out because of the fact that the cycle has a size that scales with G and M. Okay. Now you look at the equations of motion from this thing, I wrote down the potential, so it's easy to write down the equations of motion. They look like this. And they can be solved by taking constant matrices, okay, which is what Wadi went through yesterday in the colloquium. Okay, this is the same as Myers' dielectric effect. So if you take phis, which commute and in this way to form an SU2 representation, or the generator is an SU2 representation, so phi I, phi j is epsilon phi k, then you'll extremize b.
So if you had a quadratic term like what you're suggesting, then that would spoil it, or not?
Well, it would mean that there'd be two possible minutes, one phi equals 0, one phi not 0, to compare.
Okay.
I suggest lower.
In the supersymmetric case, the degenerate.
In this case, I'm going to claim the other one's lower, but I haven't gone through it with that term. So.
It's an interesting question.
Yeah. Last one.
Yeah.
You can see all of them count because phi is of the order of f. So the first term is like phi cubed, the next one is phi cubed, so there should be you get f squared and phi squared.
Then there's a coefficient question.
Yeah, all of them have the same.
Okay. This whole thing is Clevenger's transfer, Mary's Polchinski transfer, right? Or
in some sense, yes. Yeah, that's what it is.
And then we have that term.
Okay. You say there's an f squared phi squared just not in Myers' paper, but comes out of the more expanding deck Q.
And in the supersymmetric case, it's unambiguous. And in this case, also it's unambiguous because it's just the effect that I said.
So in the supersymmetric case,
in most cases, there's no, you can't. It's hard to determine what it is, but here you have a nice clean thing because it comes just from the warp factor pulling in the free brain, and the free brain.
But that don't you just see from the, well, okay.
There should be some effect for P equals 1, disturbing those that everything
of 5. Let me continue with this, because I'm not in real time going to change everything. Right. Okay. So we're taking the constant matrices, which are proportional to generators of an SU2 rep. Since phi is p by p, they're generators of some p-dimensional SU2 rep. And any such p-dimensional representation will do. The value of the energy in a given p-dimensional representation depends on the quadratic Casimir. And if you just plug those in, it turns out that the potential is minimized by taking the largest non-trivial, the reducible representation of dimension p. So it looks like that. So we can exactly reproduce this formula, okay, by starting a different calculation where we have an NS5 brain wrapping an S2 inside the A cycle. So it's a sphere in the A cycle, parameterized by some angle, which you can call psi, that says which S2 it is in the A cycle. And you minimize that potential for psi in the background of the fluxes, and you find exactly the same energetics. Okay. So the interpretation of this is that the three bars blow up into one of these sort of two spheres in the S3, and they become an NS5 brain wrapping the S2. Okay.
Fuzzy, or?
It doesn't matter at all for this that it's fuzzy, for the NS5 computation.
If you added D3 rather than untitled state, would it be the same effect?
No, for D3s, what actually happens is, you remember I said at some point there are two terms that are the same by self-duality in computing this action. And what happens if you add the D3s instead of the anti-D3s is that those two terms cancel. Okay, so here they were the same, but there's a sign issue. And for D3s, they cancel. For D3 bars, they add. And that's as it should be. D3 bars should be free to move around in the convolved geometry. So I want to talk about what we think this means in the dual quantum field theory.
Sorry, so this blown up anti-D3 brain is the new non-supersymmetric vacuum that you were referring to?
Yeah, good. So we now have a 5 brain, which is wrapping an S2 inside the S3. Okay. This is supposed to be, so here's V. Here's some schematic function of the field, and this is supposed to be the NS5 brain vacuum here. And then eventually you just get down to the system of M minus PD3 brains, probably a convolved. Okay. Okay, so we argued that our eventual final state is just one of these cases of Hubbenov and Straffler, where you have a product group with those numbers. Yeah.
When you have this NS5 brain, when you go to the Bohnian production, there's also a supergravity interaction between the opposite sides of the NS5 brain. Do you think that might spoil the computation? So basically, you have the Bohnian production of the NS5 brain, historical, and you get those two terms, but then I feel like back-to-back.
Well, okay, so all I can say is we, of course, took into account whatever terms we know of for the NS5 brain, and the calculation agreed with the D3 bar calculation. So if we did miss a term in the D3 bar calculation, we have naturally either missed a term in the NS5 calculation, or the two don't exactly agree. But
they should agree.
I can't say no.
You're saying the NS1 is the one to trust anyway.
The NS1 is clearly the one to trust. Mm-hmm. So there, it's just a big 5 brain wrapping a large 2 sphere with small flux tensors. Okay. So our question was going to be, in the holographic dual, can we find the non-supersymmetric state as some kind of metastable vacuum? And to talk about that at all, I'm first going to go back to cases that Matt and Igor discussed, which are just supersymmetric. There's no non-supersymmetric state. That is, I'm going to take the moment where there are no D3 bars. So take P equals 0. Okay. As P goes to 0, that group I just described becomes SU2M times SUM. Okay. And of course, we said there's another step in the cascade, and the eventual gauge theory is just pure SUM. But let's analyze it in this language instead, okay? And then try to figure out what happens when P is non-zero. So to do that, I'm going to take the limit where lambda here is going to 0 in this SUM factor, and just analyze this SU2M gauge group and try to understand some features of this gauge theory. Okay. So the SU2M gauge group has 2M flavors of quarks because it had bifundamentals connecting it with this SUM, and that's now become just a global symmetry. Now, Seiberg said something interesting about supersymmetric QCD in exactly this case where the number of flavors is the same as the number of colors. Okay, he said that the moduli space of that theory is quantum mechanically modified. So we ignore the quartic superdetensional and all that fancy stuff, but let's just talk about that first. So you can define mesons and baryons, which are gauge invariant variables, by being bilinears in the A's and B's, or products of all the A's, or products of all the B's. So that's the antibaryon, the baryon, and these are a bunch of mesons.
Alpha and beta are indices under the SUM, you're taking the SUM coupling mesons.
That's right. That's the SUM lambda is going to zero.
Oh, okay.
Then in the theory that Seiberg analyzed, which had no tree-level superpotential, at least, you found that the classical moduli space, just by statistics of the quarks, looks like this, or this is just an identity. The determinant of the N matrix, viewed as a 2M by 2M matrix, is equal to BB tilde. And in the quantum theory, that's almost true, but there's a quantum correction. So this has a sort of instanton term in it that says the moduli space quantum mechanically looks like this. Now, in this system, you could talk about mesonic and baryonic vacua, where either N is non-zero for mesonic or B is non-zero for baryonic. Okay? But there's not much sense in doing that because they're connected by motion in this moduli space. So, you know, you can just smoothly interpolate between them. Now, we almost have this theory. We also have a tree-level superpotential that looks like this. And what this addition of the tree-level superpotential does is disconnect what you might naturally call mesonic and baryonic vacua. So if you analyze the dynamics of the theory with this addition to W, okay, and you impose this by adding Lagrange multiplier and so forth, you'll find that the space of vacua looks like this. There's some potential, and here's the space of quark fabs if you want. And here's the old mesonic vacua, and here's the baryonic vacua, but now there's a Hilbert. If you analyze the structure of those branches separately, the mesonic branch looks like, in terms of a moduli space, MD3 brains probing the conifold, okay? Which is what Igor and Matt said was that SU2M times SU1 theory. And the baryonic branch looks like pure SU1 gauge theory with M-isolated vacua. So the different steps in that cascade seem to be these different vacua of the supersymmetric gauge theory. And, of course, you can write down a domain wall here, too. In this case, it's exactly a supersymmetric domain wall, and you can study its properties. Okay. So what we believe happens for p greater than 0 is the following. You have these separated supersymmetric vacua when p is 0. Okay. So you can intuitively consider doing a small p over m expansion. Okay. You can try to think what would be a small deformation of that picture. Okay. And, well, there's still an analog of these mesonic vacua.
I'm sorry, yeah. Before you go into P not zero, could you say again? So in the other case, we can imagine either having M mobile V3 brains or all of them dissolved in flux.
Right.
And you're saying one of those is mesonic and one is baryonic? Or?
That's what I would say.
Which is which?
The mesonic one is the one with the mobile brains.
Because you have a order M squared degrees of freedom, which you're talking
about. And the baryonic one is...
In form of, say, field theory, like that we consider, you always could view it in such a way that you have a kind of discrete vacuum if you introduce some kind of perturbation. Analog of mass storm, yeah? You are saying that your matter fields are not massless, but, you know, massive, and dependent, you know, what kind of perturbation you introduce, you are, would be either mesonic or baryonic vacuum, dependent what kind of perturbation you introduce. When you are adding this superpotential, you are adding, it's another perturbation, right? Different, I mean, it's not like, you know, this mastom, but still, it's kind of, I mean, of perturbation. And in this sense, You know, with all the type of perturbation, you also have discrete vacuum, right? Because this relation that you are on this surface corresponds to the form factor. You have this family of this vacuum area, which is fixed if I use the perturbation. But then if I'm going to the limit of perturbation is small, I'm covering, you know, all this.
Well, I agree. Okay. There, right? And what you're saying is if you add a mass.
And now they're using another perturbation, but in this sense, this perturbation also, if we consider this lambda to be small, also you are fixing, you know, at which point on this manifold you are, right? On this vacuum.
Not quite, but you've got whole branches here.
Yeah, sorry?
You have whole branches in this case. You don't have isolated.
At very
but they isolated if you introduce particular perturbation like a mass stop, right?
If you added a mass,
this particular perturbation, you get branches which are separate.
Okay.
If you added a mass term in addition to lambda, you could choose to land on different points in the mesonic branch.
Yeah.
But you pick where. But with just lambda, as you take the limit, you're either.
No, I mean that it would be a section which is still
not degenerate,
not discrete point. Yeah. I agree. But you can have both, right? So then you have discrete, and then you have it's additional, and then it's a problem of which perturbation is larger, right?
I don't disagree with that, but what seems to happen in the string theory system is that you have lambda and not the mass perturbation.
Mm-hmm.
So it's unambiguous what you should look at. And the mesonic branch corresponds precisely to the M brains probing the conifold with the expected moduli space, and the other branch corresponds to the pure gauge theory that was conjectured to be there.
And one thing you haven't said, maybe it's worth saying, is if you take an SU3M cross SU2M, my guess is you get an additional branch.
Absolutely, you probably get three. So I think this can
be right. There's probably an infinite set of branches, although I really crude that for the filter case and work.
Right, I think you could go infinitely up, and these are the other domain walls with more NS charge. Okay. So what I did want to say is what we think happens for p greater than zero. And what we are thinking happens is the following. We have these two disconnected branches of moduli space, okay, separated by some potential barrier. And our guess was that what happens is there's still a supersymmetric mesonic endpoint, okay, and that you can convince yourself of by gauge theory analysis, with M minus P D3 brains instead of M. They have their moduli space, which is M minus P copies of the conifold, and that agrees with our earlier supersymmetric endpoint. Okay. But this baryonic branch, we think, gets kicked up in energy. But for small enough P, or small enough P over M, it gets kicked up little enough that you can't quite just roll down this hill. It gets kicked up a little bit. So there's still two disconnected branches. It's just that one of them is no longer supersymmetric. It's not at V equals zero. Okay. Now, the supersymmetric vacuum for P greater than zero has this group. What would we mean by this kind of structure? Well, there are now two M minus two P flavors in this gauge factor, in the SU2M minus P factor. So a priori, when P is non-zero, you can't make baryons. Okay, I mean, if you look at the definition of a baryon, it requires you to have enough stuff there, enough flavors. Okay, so you can't define gauge invariant baryons. But what you can do, what you can consider, is taking some subgroup of that SU2M minus P, an SU2M minus 2P subgroup, okay, and roughly speaking, make non-supersymmetric baryonic vacua of that, okay, leaving an unbroken group that would look like this. Okay. Now, that there are no such supersymmetric vacua, and to make the non-supersymmetric ones would depend on details of the KR potential and blah, blah, blah. Okay. What's nice about this is exactly the symmetry that we'd expect.
Okay. So, what's the gauge invariant condensate there?
So you'd be off on some Higgs branch of SU2M minus 2P where you Higgs it down to SUP. It would be some kind of partial Higgs. Mm-hmm. Okay. And if you do that, then you get the SUP that you expect from the anti-brains and the SUM minus P that you sort of thought was left in the other factor. And that would qualitatively agree with our D3 bar theory. Now, there's also a naive 2A sort of Hanani-Witten construction of this brain anti-brain system, and that also yields this kind of gauge structure. So that's nice. And so let me summarize. I think I'm right on time. Our claim is you should be able to find a gauge theory gravity duality for a small modification of one of the systems that's already been studied before, a conifold with fluxes. you can break supersymmetry in a parametrically small way by adding anti-three brains and still say something about two sides, a field theory, and a string background. The eventual fate of the system, which is decay to a supersymmetric vacuum, involves some process by which brains and fluxes annihilate with each other, which is non-perturbatively slow and therefore not that interesting for small enough p, but as you crank up p, it seems to become faster and faster, and I think that's reliably computed using the NS5 brain world volume. Okay. And the real reason I studied this is that this system and relatives of it might arise as natural models for supersymmetry breaking or for kicking up the vacuum energy in string compactifications of the sort that I've been interested in that have fluxes and therefore few moduli. Okay. So that's all I wanted to say about that, and I can say words about fixing moduli quickly, or I can end here, it doesn't matter.
I think
we
would like to hear, right?
I think so. Yeah.
Okay. No, there will be no dissenter. So I'm going to say something really boring about fixing moduli, which is why I didn't talk about it primarily. So this is logically independent of everything that came before, and so if you don't care about this kind of fixing a moduli, you know, feel free to.
Well, isn't this connected? They're connected, aren't they?
I mean, not very.
Oh.
Nothing that I did in this paper is related to anything I talked about before.
But I mean, let me ask the question then, because what we did earlier was to take and put the Klebanov-Strassler in a compact space. What if you put this in a compact space?
Good. So that is of course how I was hoping to get to sitter space.
Yeah.
I don't see a way to reliably argue that happens yet.
I mean, I think what happens is it still wants to
roll. I think what will happen is you'll roll off to infinite volume.
I think you do.
And you need a more intricate shape to superimpose on top of the.
Okay,
Joe, you could have meant many things. With what we did with Steve, it's obvious you'd roll off to infinite volume because we were at zero energy.
Right. This has a subtle dependence on the volume. It's not a trivial dependence on the volume.
Yeah, but I think to get something where you had a hope.
Yeah.
You'd have to do what we talked about doing with schemes that never did, which is where you add the O's and O bars and make an anti-de-Sitter space. And then the hope was to make an anti-de-Sitter space and add the D3 bars to kick that above zero. Okay, and that, I think, doesn't work. But anyway, let me instead give a talk that everyone wants to.
Maybe a bit orthogonal question.
Yeah.
One thing is that gates for gravity have something to do with non-trivial conductivity. Constructing, you know, developing techniques in gates of gravity, and analyzing the actual potentials that can appear in this context, could shed light also on the possible back here or how they are connected, how whether one can get, you know, stable enough the sitter vacuum. So,
I think that's right. I can say something about that at the end.
It strikes me those things are very special, right? I mean, you have good control over where it's coming from. But on the other hand, it's not complex, so it's hard to see it helps realize.
What I was just talking about?
Both. The sitter, right? The sitter ground state.
Well, let me say what I can instead of telling you how I can't get to sitter space. So I'm going to talk now about some work I did with Mike Schultz and Sandeep Trivedi. A lot of other people have worked on very similar things in many different languages, so some people are listed here. Many others worked on it in the language of M theory on Calabi-Yau fourfolds. But all the physics is basically the same. So we go back again to the system we started with. We have a Calabi-Yau, we have some cycles with fluxes, and we have some wandering brains. Okay? And this should only take about 10 minutes. So tadpole cancellation for D3 charge tells you in this kind of system that, well, you have some O planes around, and some D brains, and some fluxes, and the total D3 charge better be zero. So the number of D3s plus this flux contribution to D3 charge should equal the number of O planes. Okay, so that's fair. And here H and F are the RR and NS3 forms. Now, the basic point of what I'll tell you is that very explicitly in ways that you can compute, vacua with H and F non-zero can have less brains, and so lower ranks and less brain moduli, and also less shape and size moduli of this Calabi-Yau space. Okay, but that's a computable effect, and so it gives you a way of making models with lower ranks and less moduli.
Why is no rank good?
Some people like low rank. I mean, just from the point of view of moduli, it's good because a lot of these D3 brains come with extra moduli. So it's open string moduli versus closed string. Okay. So let's define a combination of the two three-form fluxes like that, superimposed with a factor of the Dalton between them. Okay. Then, if you just take the type 2b Lagrangian in 10 dimensions and you reduce it on a 6-manifold, M, okay, and I'm assuming here throughout M is Calabi-Yau, then it contains a term that looks like this. Okay, so this is some scalar potential. Where I've broken up this G, this three form, into pieces which are either imaginary self-dual or imaginary anti-self-dual. So two forms in four dimensions are either self-dual or anti-self-dual. In three complex dimensions, you instead get I's entering those kinds of relations. So you can break a three form into an ISD and an IASD piece. And this potential is the square of the IASD piece. Okay. So to minimize this potential, clearly what you do is you choose things so that the IASD piece of this three form vanishes. The reason that depends on moduli and will therefore fix them is that, first of all, the split into these two types of forms depends on the complex structure of the space. It depends on the shape of the Calabi-Yau. And so having fixed the topological class of these fluxes, that will fix moduli. And then also there's an explicit dependence on phi just sitting there. So the Dalton will get fixed. And in fact, the potential, this V, can be derived from the standard framework of n equals 1 supergravity, where you take exactly the superpotential I was telling you about before, the fluxes wedged into the holomorphic 3 form, you interpret that as the superpotential of an n equals 1 supergravity, and you use the standard kinetic terms that would follow from reduction of 2b supergravity on a Calabi-Yau. Okay, so with the standard Kr potential and that superpotential, you would reproduce that flux squared term. So it really is just what you expect from four-dimensional supersymmetric theories.
Genuine equal for
any
one theory then?
Yeah.
Still,
kernel
potential is just
three levels. Minus 3 log tau minus tau bar or minus blah, blah, blah.
But yeah.
They're corrections. Exactly. But for the supersymmetric vacuum, the corrections shouldn't matter. Okay, so the strategy is clear. You choose a topology of these fluxes. They're three forms, and they're integral three forms. Fluxes are quantized. Okay, and then you compute W as a function of moduli, and you minimize V. All this requires is knowledge of how to compute that superpotential I wrote down. That depended on integrals of omega wedged with F and H, or what are called periods of this omega over the dual cycles to F and H. So you just need to know that data. And I'm being so straightforward and boring about this because the nice thing here isn't that there's a fabulous new physical effect. It's that this is a context in string theory where you can just compute these things. There's no unknown instanton sum or dependence on things that you can't do. So let me just discuss this in a very simple example, that of type 2b on T6 mod Z2. Okay. What is T6 mod Z2? Well, if there were no fluxes present, okay, this is just the orientifold where you reflect all the directions. It's the T-dual of the T6 compactification of type 1 string theory. So you started with, depending how you count, 16 or 32 9 brains. They result in 16 or 32 3 brains, and then 64 of 3 planes, and some n equals 4 supersymmetric system. Now with flux, you instead get a potential which is very computable, and which I'll tell you now. So to do that, I should first choose a basis for what my fluxes can be, a basis for the integral 3 forms.
But that's only the n equals 2, right?
Excuse me?
This is bigger supersymmetry than n equals 1.
This is n equals 4 so far. It's not going to be in a second. Okay. So that would be if I didn't turn on any fluxes. That would be n equals 4 supersymmetric, like type 1. Okay. Now, the fluxes can be expanded in a basis of integral 3 forms. For the 3 torus, it's easy to give a nice basis that looks like this. So there's 1 of these, 9 of these, 9 of these, and 1 of these. 20 integral 3 forms. So you can take F and H, your quantized fluxes, and expand them with integer coefficients in that basis. So you have some integers A, Aij, B, and Bij, and C, Cij, D, Dij. Okay. So there you choose just integer coefficients. For a fixed choice of these integers, you get a four-dimensional theory. So you should view them as superselection parameters that God fixes at the beginning of your compactification, but we can survey what would happen with different choices. So for our torus, let's choose a torus where the complex coordinates are written this way in terms of real periodic variables x and y, where I and j go from 1 to 3. So the complex structure, the moduli of this torus, are hidden in this matrix tau ij, which just generalizes the tau of a two torus. And the holomorphic 3 form is just dz, dz, dz. So if you expand it out in terms of this tau, it has some nice expansion in that integral basis. It's alpha naught plus tau times alpha plus so forth. Cof here is just the matrix of cofactors. So you plug in. Here's f and h. We had a formula for the superpotential, which was just some sum of these wedged into omega, okay, and integrated. So you can just do that. It's a torus. And what you get is a formula for a superpotential that looks like this, okay, with all the moduli dependents very explicitly displayed in terms of phi and tau. And then you look for supersymmetric solutions, those with d tau and d phi and w itself equal to 0. The only, yeah.
So if you satisfy that, you're guaranteed to have at least n equals 1 student.
That's right, but you might have more. You might have more. Okay. And that's related to the fact that there are more choices of tau here than there are different metrics on the torus. But anyway, that's right. If you just solve this for some tau here.
Sorry, so
how
did you break it down to n equal
1? I didn't. So all I did is say that.
You're writing n equal 1 super.
So what I said is, good, well, let me explain that better. So there's a formula for the scalar potential. And all I'm saying is that that scalar potential can be expressed, okay, as using n equals 1 formulas in terms of the Kr potential that you know and this w. So it would be, you know, Kij wi wj minus 3w squared.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can I just ask, how do you know, you're implicit, or maybe you said it and I missed it, any choice of integers for that coefficients will give you a solution to the full supergravity equations of motion, yes?
Let me say in just a second what I know about solutions.
Okay.
So, okay. You can choose those integers.
This is Chopin, what you're saying, this is a consistency condition, but you haven't actually.
Right. All I'm saying is for a choice of integers, you get this potential. It could be that something terrible happens, the potential has no minima. No supersymmetric minimum, and I'll say whatever I know about that now.
Are you guaranteed that this even corresponds to some kind of a solution? That the fluxes being those values we're looking for?
Well, that's what I'm about to tell you.
Okay.
Okay, right. So what you get is these equations. W is given explicitly in terms of those fluxes. If you didn't want supersymmetry, the equations you'd get would look like this, equals 0. Okay. If you want supersymmetry too, you impose that, because we have a no-scale supergravity, okay, some technical reason. But if you can solve those equations, then you're guaranteed that there's a solution. So it's a question. Okay. If you just count the number of equations and the number of fields.
So that's what I was sort of asking. So that is a complete set of equations.
This is a complete set of equations. And if you count the number of equations, there's 10 equations here, and there's 10 fields, tau, ij, and phi. So you think you can solve them, okay, for any choice of fluxes. And if you add this equation, there's now 11 equations and 10 fields, and you think you can't. Is that your question?
Yeah.
Okay. So then the answer to that question would be that for generic choices of these fluxes, of these just topological characteristics of these fluxes, there are no supersymmetric solutions, okay, though there are non-supersymmetric solutions. But if you choose the fluxes to be special, so you fine-tune discretely, okay, you choose your discrete initial parameters well, okay, you can find solutions that are supersymmetric. And in this particular case, because it was so simple, it was just a torus, you can find solutions with a variety of different amounts of supersymmetry. So the fluxes can preserve four-dimensional n equals 1. We gave some examples of that, or n equals 2. Or there's this weird structure, four-dimensional n equals 3, that Joe and his student have explored in a recent paper. So you can find this variety of choices. If you did this in a more generic case, instead of starting with a torus, you used a more of a real Calabi-Yau, then you would really be finding sort of n equals 1 and n equals 0, and not also n equals 2 and 3. Okay. But even in this simple case, you can find lots of examples with, instead of the n equals 4, n equals 1.
You're sticking to tuning cosmological constant to 0. Is that an additional strong constraint?
No, there's no tuning at all.
No tuning. You want to ensure that this
That's guaranteed by the no-scale structure in finding a supersymmetric solution. For a non-supersymmetric solution, the no-scale structure would also guarantee that, but it would be violated at one loop in every expansion. For the supersymmetric cases, there's no reason to think it's violated at one loop in every expansion.
So effectively, that no-scale supergravity?
So you get n equals 1's, yeah, right, n equals 1 supersymmetric, no-scale supergravity. Right. Okay. Let's just see what we've done here. The T-dual of type 1, the sort of standard benchmark in this model, has some number of moduli you can count. There's 18 from the torus because there's, you have a symmetric and an anti-symmetric 6x6 matrix, so you can just count. And there's 48 from the three brains that can wander all over the torus. And there's a dilaton, okay, so that's some number 67. It would normally be larger for more generic Calabi-Yau's. Here, you can get the number of closed string moduli down to 3. The reason it's 3 has to do with the fact that this is a torus and it's so simple. If you let me work with more general Calabi-Yau's, I think I could make it 1. You can get down to no moduli from the brains if you don't want to have any brains present. But if you add brains, they'll come with moduli. So depending on how you broke up your flux between fluxes and brains, you'll have fewer open string moduli, but varying numbers. So, okay, I mean, a real goal in figuring out how to fix moduli might be to try and make stringy examples of De Sitter space, and then discuss all the fascinating conjectures about quantum gravity in De Sitter space in some concrete setting. That is a lofty goal I won't say anything about. But given that we just heard Gary's talk yesterday and Ibanez's talk the day before, here's what I think is a more accessible goal, certainly. You should now, here's what the state of the art is with some degree of elegance, make models where you have, say, a Calabi-Yau and it has a singularity in it, okay, and you have some fluxes present, and there are a handful of D3 brains present, but since the Calabi-Yau has a singularity, you can stick them at the singular point. That gives rise to an interesting gauge theory. By interesting here, I don't mean necessarily the standard model. That's hard to get. I just mean something that looks better than n equals 4 with its Coulomb branch. Okay. So I think you can now probably make string models that have almost no moduli and some interesting gauge theory sitting there. Okay. And if you want to be safe with all that, n equals 1 supersymmetry. The advantage of this over previous constructions, as far as I can tell, is only that you've calculably fixed most of the moduli. And it would be in a sort of brain world framework, if you like that. Okay. Examples of this sort already actually exist in the sense that Joe and Steve and I talked about them, but they weren't exactly like this. We instead had embedded this Clebanov-Strassler dual of a non-chiral gauge theory. And also we had broken supersymmetry, so you could add supersymmetry and be more satisfied about the result if you like it. That's all I had to say. What?
Completely stabilize us.
No.
So I think I missed. What about the Keller class and the dilaton moduli?
So the dilaton in these vacua is generically stabilized, and the Kaler classes generically aren't. You get some of them if you impose supersymmetry from this primitivity condition, but not all of them. And the non-stability of the Kaler moduli is related to this no-scale structure. They just cancel out of the energy. So you can get down to one modulus easily by fixing the dilaton and having only one Kaler class. But doing better than that.
Could you explain a little more what you mean when you say no scale structure? What do you mean?
Yeah, well, let me tell you what I would mean if there weren't a T6 here, because with the T6, things are more symmetric and it gets complicated. But what I think I mean is the following. So you have a superpotential, which depends, in this case, on some fields phi and tau I. I call them tau ij, it doesn't matter, okay? And you have a potential, which is given by some formula that looks like, okay, so there's some standard supergravity formula for that. Now, there are other fields in this game, rho. And for those who know, the tau I are complex structure moduli, the rho's are Kaler moduli. So one could consider an example where there's just one such other field. W does not depend on rho, okay? But d rho of W is, of course, not 0. It's covariantized, So there's a KOR potential derived with respect to rho and multiplying W. If you plug in this form for d rho W in these so-called no-scale models, what happens is you sum over I and J, which are not rho, okay, and the rho term in this sum just cancels off the 3W squared. So that's what I'm calling no-scale. And then the energy is positive semi-definite. When it vanishes, you have a solution, but it's only a supersymmetric solution if, in addition, W is zero, because otherwise the F term for rho, the auxiliary component in rho is not zero.
So then you have something like normal global supersymmetry results as W-tone, right?
Yeah, except for this additional constraint that W should be zero for supersymmetry.
Yeah.
In normal field theory, you wouldn't.
It's essentially this log behavior, right?
It's the log behavior. Right now, in a supersymmetric solution, it wouldn't matter if that log behavior got corrected, which it surely will, because W was zero anyway. Okay? W was zero for supersymmetry. But if it's a non-supersymmetric solution, it would matter, and this whole structure would break down as soon as you correct the KOR.
I'm sorry, Brian, so why should W be zero? I thought only covariant derivative of W have to be zero for supersymmetry.
Right, d rho of W is proportional to W.
Because